This morning, we're catching up with Abdu Murray, who is the Senior Vice President of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Good morning. How are you going, Abdu?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, of course, it's not morning for you, though. You're over there in the States, aren't you?
It is closer to the evening. Yes, that is true.
And look, first of all, may I say congratulations on your book, Seeing Jesus from the East, which you co-wrote with Ravi Zacharias. And could I just ask you, because you've previously mentioned that you were a devout Muslim, and now you're part of the senior management of an international Christian ministry that is sharing the love of Jesus around the world. That sounds like a fascinating story. Do you mind sharing it with us?
I'd be happy to. You know, a funny thing happened on the way to the mosque, as they say. when I was growing up, I grew up in the United States. And I was born into a Shia Muslim family. Now, there's two different kinds of Muslims. The two big divisions within Islam are the Sunnis, which are the majority. Then there's the Shia, or also known as the Shiites, which are a minority. Now, they're a very large minority, estimates between 15 to 25%, depending on who you ask. And largely, the beliefs and practices are exactly the same. But I took my Islam pretty seriously. And I wanted people to believe true things and not false things when I was growing up. And I would have none of this sort of like relativistic idea of what's true for you is equally true as what's true for me, even if they're contradictory. I would have none of that. But no. If something is true, it's true for everyone. If something is false, it's false for everyone. And I thought Islam was true. So at a young age, I would engage in conversations with non-Muslims about what their belief systems were, why they were wrong, and why I was right. And I could engage in lots of these conversations because the suburb of Detroit that I grew up in at the time was not very diverse in terms of ethnicity or in terms of religion. There were a few Muslim families there, and there were some, you know, occasionally some Indians or some African-Americans and that kind of thing, but not a whole lot. So I would say that we were sort of the dollop of olive oil in a pot of rice in the area we grew up in. So we were exotic. I would engage in conversations with Christians, and I'd ask them a fundamental question. Why are you a Christian? And the answer was almost always, I don't know, tradition, I suppose. And so I'd have a follow-up question, and the question was, why would you trust your eternal soul to a worldview that someone else believes? If tradition is your only reason, that means you did not look into it. And you're trusting your soul to a belief system that you didn't think through. But I have thought it through for you, and here's 15 reasons why you're wrong. I was pretty good at it. But there were some Christians who actually knew what they were talking about, who not only responded to my objections, but had some objections of their own. And they got me thinking that maybe this whole Christian thing isn't as silly as I once thought it was. And so I began to investigate it more and more. And was becoming uncomfortable with just how reasonable it was sounding, not only historically, but philosophically and theologically. So that was sort of the beginning of the journey. But then I came across a passage in Luke chapter 3, verse 7, and I was trying to debunk the Bible. I was reading the Bible to debunk it. And I came across this passage where John the Baptist is talking to those who are being baptized by him, and he says to them, who told you to flee from the wrath to come, meaning God's judgment? And he said, do not even begin to think to yourself you have Abraham as your father, for I tell you God can raise up children of Abraham from the stones. And it suddenly struck me when I read that. What John the Baptist was saying is that tradition does not save you, but truth saves you. That's what I had been saying to Christians, but I wasn't really taking it in myself. I realized in that moment the reason I was a Muslim, even though I could conjure up a bunch of arguments in favor of it, was largely because I was raised that way and I was supposed to be. And that began a 9-year journey into the evidence for the Christian faith. I decided that day that I was going to be as objective as I possibly could be. Now, that's not always possible, but I was trying my best. And over the course of 9 years of study, I began to see the historical evidence for the resurrection, for the reliability of the Bible, that Jesus claimed to be who he said he was in the New Testament as a matter of history, that he died on the cross and he rose from the dead to prove he was right. But the linchpin argument here, the linchpin part of the whole story here is this. It didn't take me 9 years because the answers were hard to find. They were actually quite easy to find. It took me 9 years because the answers were hard to accept.
Yes.
I did not want to lose the identity I had as a Muslim, and I needed to stay that way. But the evidence was just too compelling. You know, and it's interesting because this is something that people don't really quite get the grasp of, is that I'm a part of an apologetics ministry, RZIM. Our tagline is helping the thinker to believe and the believer to think. So apologetically, or what is a matter of defense of the faith, that is all what it's about. It's about defending the faith. But the problem is oftentimes evidence matters only to a certain degree to people because of the price they pay. And there's many prices. There's family issues. There's community issues. There's, of course, the identity issues as well. But you know what's interesting about this, Fee, is that what I began to see was this, is that at some point the price becomes worth it to pay. One is that truth is always worth it. Truth is not always convenient, but it is always, in the end, worth it. And in the Christian faith, it's not just propositional truths. It's actually a personal truth. And I don't mean relativist. What I mean is it's not true to me. It's that the Christian faith says that truth is ultimately rooted in a person who is the person of Christ. So not only do you get a propositional truth that describes the way the world is, but it describes specifically who the maker of the world actually is. And you get that personal relationship with him, which makes it worth it. But if I could just back up for a moment, and here's where it all coalesced for me. You know, we often hear Muslims say this phrase, Allahu Akbar. We hear them say this phrase. And when they say that phrase, we get a little bit nervous because what people are, we say, oh my goodness, this is a terrorist chant or some kind of violence is going to ensue. But the reality is most Muslims don't say Allahu Akbar as a terrorist cry. They're saying it as a prayer and a praise. The moderate Muslims among us, the peace-loving Muslims among us say that. And what it means is God is greater. So for the Muslim, God's greatness is the greatest part of what it means to believe in God. So a Muslim searches for God's greatness. Well, I had rejected Christianity because I thought it insulted God's greatness, especially at the cross. How could the maker of the universe die on a shameful cross at the hands of the very people he created? You know, that kind of a thing. But then I realized something, and this is where it all came coalescing for me, that if God is the greatest possible being, as Muslims believe, then he would express the greatest possible ethic, which is love. And he would express the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way. And the greatest possible way to express love is self-sacrifice. And that's what the cross is all about, is God expressing love in the greatest possible way. So if God is the greatest possible being, as every Muslim believes, then he must be the God of the cross. And only the Christian faith tells you about a God who expresses himself in the greatest possible way through the greatest possible device, which is, in fact, the cross. When I found that out, when I discovered that, I realized that God has paid for me a price greater than any price I might have to pay to follow him. And that's when I bowed my knee, and God made me a child of Abraham from a stone.
Wow.
That cross.
Wow. What an incredible story, Abdu. Before we go, I've always been intrigued. I have one last question for you, and you'd be in the prime position to answer this, having seen both sides of this coin. I was once told that in the Quran that Muhammad is mentioned 4 times, but Jesus is mentioned over 20 times. Is that true?
Actually, Jesus is probably mentioned more than that. And yes, Muhammad, while Muhammad is only mentioned a scant few times by name or by direct address, it's implied numerous times throughout the Quran. But yes, you're right. Jesus is actually mentioned specifically by name quite numerously. So Muslims actually do have a high sense of respect for Jesus, but they also do deny his divinity and his cross. And so to quote Samuel Zwamer, they sort of betray the Son of Man with a kiss, is that they want to give him his due as a prophet, but they want to rob him of his ontology or his nature as the Son of God who takes away the sins of the world. So we can use that as a way to talk to our Muslim friends because they have a high respect for Jesus. We have to point them to who Jesus really is. And the only place you really find out who Jesus is in the pages of Holy Scripture.
Fantastic. Lovely chatting with you today, Abdu. I look forward to chatting again in the future.
I hope this can happen soon. Thank you so much for having me.